Isaiah chapter 23, the burden of Tyre. Howl, ye ships of Tarshish, for it is laid waste, so that there is no house, no entering in. From the land of Kittim it is revealed to them. Be still, ye inhabitants of the isle, thou whom the merchants of Zidon that pass over the sea have replenished. And by great waters the seed of Sihor, the harvest of the river, is her revenue, and she is a mart of nations. Be thou ashamed, O Zidon, for the sea hath spoken, even the strength of the sea, saying, I travail not, nor bring forth children, neither do I nourish up young men, nor bring up virgins. Isaiah chapter 23 is the burden of Tyre. Tyre being that coastal city in what is now modern Lebanon, to the north of where Israel was and is today. The Tarshish ships. Now these ships are referred to in the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel and Judah as the ships that brought the silver for King Solomon. And there's a lot of different opinions about where this Tarshish was. And it's interesting because some people place it in Spain, sometimes called the Iberian Peninsula. That's the Spanish Peninsula. Others place it in some other islands, including Sardinia, in the Mediterranean. But the funny thing is they have trouble pinpointing the exact location of Tarshish, because the name Tarshish itself, the root meaning of Tarshish means to smelt. And so it's basically the equivalent of like smelt town, smelting town, smeltingsburg, whatever you like. Well, apparently there are a lot of places in the Mediterranean with names that sound an awful lot like Tarshish. So there could be a lot of places on these islands throughout the Mediterranean named Smelt Town. And, you know, the Tarshish ships in the book of, I forget which exactly, if it was Kings or Chronicles, but they brought stuff including peacocks and apes, at least in the King James, and also metals such as silver. They brought those every 3 years. And that's led some people to think like, well, you know, the Iberian Peninsula is a long way away. A 3 years voyage, though, seems a bit steep, honestly, at least to me. Unless you're making the rounds at all these different Tarshishes. And I think maybe that somehow plays into it. They are the ships of Tarshish. The Tarshish ships. They go around and trade in the Mediterranean and bring back silver and gold and other metals to trade for various goods. In verse 3, when it says, you know, the seed of Sihor. Sihor means the Black River, which is taken, you know, I got to go based on what people who know more about the language than I do say. Basically, it means the Nile, the grain trade. Basically, even into Roman times, there was a grain trade from Egypt into the rest of the Mediterranean. And these ships would go around trading for grain and other goods. It was basically the merchant ships. And Tyre, of course, was a notable merchant city. The other reference here in verse 1, to the land of Kittim. Kittim is, I think, agreed to be a city or a city-state on the island of Cyprus. And some people have tried to identify Kittim with, you know, with America and stuff like that. I think that's a bit stretching it. I certainly would not. Now, as far as interpretation, I mean, obviously, he's talking about the doom of Tyre, what's going to happen against Tyre, right? The bad things that are coming. When I want to apply these prophecies to the book of Revelation. Because I'm not a big applying prophecy to right now. You know, that's a mindset that has, I think, plagued people who have wanted to know God since time immemorial. Everyone wants to know what's going to happen. What's next? They figure God knows everything. God knows the end from the beginning. So, hey, God, how about telling us about the future? What's going to happen in my time? The apostles were infected with this. They were always trying to figure out when, you know, the Lord was going to bring in his kingdom, when he was going to punish the Romans, when he was going to overthrow the world order and bring in the new age. There's nothing wrong with that curiosity. But we do not have the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other. And whenever, let's say, Lebanon comes into the news, we turn to Isaiah 23 or passages in Jeremiah that also reference Tyre or Ezekiel 28 and try to read something into it. Like, oh, something's happening in Lebanon, so that means, guess what? Jesus, he's coming soon. Or his coming is closer than it ever was. And isn't that true every second that goes by? Okay. Now, my take on this, I'm going to get away from just talking about what everybody else does and the mistakes they make. What is the right way to look at this? You know, I see in this a very clear type, a clear motif we see prophetically in the book of Revelation, chapters 17 and 18, especially 18, the laments of the merchants at the burning of the great city, Mystery Babylon. At her burning, you know, the merchants all gather around, and there's all this merchandise. You know, the merchandise of gold and of silver and of precious stones, of pearls and fine linen. And we're not going to read it all there. I just want to reference it. For those of you who know, if you don't, you know, I have an entire study on Revelation. In chapter 18, well, let's look at a couple verses, though. In chapter 18, verse 11, it says, "And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buyeth their merchandise anymore. The merchandise of gold and of silver and of precious stones and of pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet, and all fine wood, all manner of vessels of ivory, and all manner of vessels of most precious wood, and of brass and iron and marble, and cinnamon and odors and ointments and frankincense and wine and oil, and fine flour and wheat, and beasts and sheep and horses and chariots and slaves and souls of men. The fruits that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee. All things which are dainty and goodly are departed from thee, and thou shalt find them no more at all." The merchants, then, they go on and they wail over her torment, or the fear of it, meaning they're scared by it, not so much that they're sorry. Alas, that great city, they weep over her fall, over the what the greatness they felt they had through her, which is lost. Now, reference all that, because I want to put it into your mind as we go through this. Because there are certainly parallels and connections. As far as it's a similar situation, we have merchants, the ships of Tarshish, and the city, Tyre. Tyre is going to be overthrown. Tyre was a sometimes ally of Israel, not always. But, you know, having the things from Revelation just in the back of our mind a little bit, the great whore, her judgment, the merchants weeping and wailing over her fall. Let's go back to Isaiah 23 and look at this detail by detail. So in verse 1 it says, "The burden of Tyre, howl ye ships of Tarshish, for it is laid waste," meaning the city of Tyre is laid waste. The ships of Tarshish have reason howl. They arrive, it is laid waste. There is no house, no entering in. In this case, house would probably refer to port, meaning there's no home for your ship. There's no place for you to dock. "From the land of Kittim it is revealed to them." Kittim, I think I said it was Cyprus, but also I forgot to mention, the name originally referred to Cyprus, but began to be extended to many of the islands throughout the Mediterranean. And so as the trading ships were returning, they would hear of the fall of Tyre. But, of course, I think they would still have to continue on their journey and their circuit around to see what has happened. Be still, ye inhabitants of the isle. Now, the isle, one of the things that's confusing in the King James is the word isle often means coasts. It can also mean like border, but here it means the coast, because at this time Tyre is not, I'm not sure if at this time it is not an island. Tyre becomes an island, but I believe it was Alexander the Great who used the stones from the old Tyre to reach to the island on the rock, or was that, whatever. It's still coastal, it's just off the coast. If they use the inlet there as a fortification, that's entirely immaterial to the study. So, thou whom the merchants of Zidon that pass over the sea have replenished. Tyre and Zidon were basically like sister cities there on the coast. The merchants have been filled up. The word replenished usually means just filled. They are made rich and filled up from the merchandise brought into this trading. And whenever this trading meant, there's always profit on, you know, everyone who tries to make the deal will try to get their best profit out of it. And by the great waters, the Sea of Sihor, the river of the river is her revenue, and she is a mart of nations. Basically, they traded through all the parts of the Mediterranean, as I already talked about. And they get the grain from Egypt, the metals from the Tarshish cities, and they trade whatever goods they could fit on their boats. Verse 4, be ashamed, O Zidon, for the sea hath spoken, even the strength of the sea, saying, the sea says, I do not travail, nor bring forth children, neither do I nourish up young men, nor bring up virgins. Now here's an interesting point. In Revelation 17, it says, the seas which thou sawest, the waters which thou sawest, on which the whore sitteth, the woman, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. Now, I remember my old teacher from when I was young, Arnold Murray, and I bring him up frequently, but he was my original Bible teacher. And a lot of his students, you get the impression that every time the sea comes up, it's symbolic of people. Whenever there's waters, it's symbolic of people. But here it isn't. The sea is personified. The sea is basically saying, look it. I don't travail. I don't bring forth children. I don't nourish up the young or bring up virgins. You know, the sea is not a nurturing and kindly, motherly thing. The way this is hitting me on a visceral level as a human being is that basically your city is gone. And the sea is saying, I can't be your mother. You know, the merchants may travel the sea, but every sailor longs to get back to shore. Nobody likes to stay out in the water forever. A long sea voyage, I mean, I'm sure some people have some sort of tolerance for that. But I'm guessing there is a limit to which anyone can take being at sea. Everyone wants to get back to shore. Everyone wants to get back to home. You know, when you go out to sea, you don't take your family with you. Not for this kind of a journey, not for a trading journey. If you're going to go colonize, yeah, you bring children and women and all that. For trading, it was just the men, there could be piracy and stuff. You don't need dead weight. And women and children are dead weight. If you're going to get in a fight, this isn't Hollywood. Sure, you can put them to use, but how much more use could you just get out of a man? I always think it's funny, you know, they show the women being useful. When there's not enough men, yeah, you got to use the women. But on a ship, there's limited space. This isn't a pleasure cruise. This is for profit. And what have they left behind? At their hometown, their women, their children. How, you ships of Tarshish? For your home is laid waste, your mother is decimated, your children and women are gone. For the city, the joyous city, is torn down. All her wealth is taken away. As at the report concerning Egypt, so shall they be sorely pained at the report of Tyre. Because remember, Egypt also, a few chapters back, we heard the king of Babylon was going to punish Egypt. He's going to punish Tyre. I mean, that's what this burden is about. That's what the whole thing, the underlying implied thing that's not even really mentioned. Because that is eventually what occurs. Verse 6, pass ye over to Tarshish, howl ye inhabitants of the isle. Pass, flee. This, in this sense, it means to flee to Tarshish. Go back, you know, go back to your smelt towns, for Tyre is laid waste. There's no home here for you. No entering in. No port. Is this your joyous city, whose antiquity is of ancient days? Her own feet shall carry her afar off to sojourn. Yeah, they're carried off into captivity over land. What will you sailors do? Who hath taken this counsel against Tyre, the crowning city, whose merchants are princes, whose traffickers are the honorable of the earth? The Lord of hosts hath purposed it to stain the pride of all glory and to bring into contempt all the honorable of the earth. You know, in Revelation 18, it is not only the merchants, but the kings of the earth, which committed fornication. You know, I am assuming the people who study with me probably have gone through my Revelation study. I'm assuming if you study with me, you probably went to Revelation early. Because that's just how people are. I mean, when I first started studying the Bible, that's what I wanted to know about. In fact, when I was a teenager, I read the Gospels, I read Revelation, I tried to read the Epistles of Paul, and I read things like the books of Kings and Genesis, and the beginning of Exodus. But after, you know, the Ten Commandments come and all that, it begins to get hard to read. I didn't read everything, but Revelation was at the top of my list. I remember trying to read Isaiah. I've told that story many times. I'm kind of assuming you have a bit of a background in Revelation. But basically, Revelation 17 and 18 describe this great whore in vision. She's this woman who sits a queen and claims not to be a widow. And my interpretation of that is that this is the apostate church, which was espoused to Christ but went after Antichrist. When he makes his appearance, they worship the devil. They worship the dragon, which gave power to the beast. And therefore, they become his. They belong to him. They become the great whore. And in 18, we have the judgment of the whore. In 17, there's a lot of interpretation. But in verse 18 of 17, it says, the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. And for some people, that's, you know, a lot of people interpret the entire book of Revelation in terms of Rome. And those people probably don't like what I have to say about that. But I don't. Though I see some of the type in that, it becomes very, if it's all just veiled references to Rome, then it's pretty boring stuff. And pretty useless to us, and why bother studying it, except for academic reasons? You know, we who have the Spirit and who are waiting for his return yet, you know that he left some word. If the prophecies of the Old Testament prophets had interpretations which extended beyond the generation of the prophets, then is it not reasonable to believe that the book of Revelation, which speaks of the end of the world, would not have a more expansive interpretation than just the end of the age that was the age of the early Christians during the Roman Empire? Yeah, I do think so myself. The woman, the great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth, I always took to be Jerusalem, or not even so much Jerusalem, but a false Jerusalem, a false city. You know, we are the citizens of the heavenly Jerusalem, according to according to the Apostle Paul. We are, you know, citizens of that city. And according to the teaching of the New Testament, we are citizens of the heavenly Jerusalem. The Jerusalem which comes down from God out of heaven. That is our city. We are the inhabitants of it. When the false Christ comes, I believe he will make people inhabitants or citizens of his city, which is that great whore. They won't think of themselves as the great whore. They will think of themselves as the city of God. And besides, she's called Babylon. Babylon was a city. Why does Babylon reign over the world? You know, is it the Babylon in Iraq? Well, it is another Babylon. It is this mystical, spiritual Babylon. The mother of all Babylons. But it says, all nations have drunk of the wine of her fornication in verse 3. And all the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. The merchants of the earth have waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. She brings about a great prosperity through all the consumerism she engages in. Because great will be the blessings of the false Christ. He will bring about many blessings. As it is written in Daniel, by peace he shall destroy many. There are many ways to peacefully destroy people, especially when you consider it the destruction of the soul. In verse 8 of Isaiah 23, Tyre is called the crowning city. That means the city that confers crowns. You know, their allegiance or their approval, they can give out, you know, they can determine who's going to be king in the other allied states that are part of this Tarshish mercantile world. But their merchants are princes. That's a metaphor. They are like princes. Their merchants are so powerful, they rival princes. Or they're just like princes. Whatever, that's a simile. The merchants are princes. And his traffickers... I can't actually read the note I wrote down for traffickers. For some reason... my handwriting is too difficult to read. Let's see if we can get a closer look. Interesting. Traffickers is Canaanites. But it is... I remember that reference. It is Canaanite, but it means a traitor. It's kind of like, oddly enough, you know, the way some people would refer to gypsies or Jews as being, you know, it's a Jew, and it's a Jewish traitor. It just means... they were traffickers because the Canaanites were noted for their trading. They are the honorable. They are the important. The word means weighty. In our modern vernacular, we would say they have a lot of gravitas. I hate that word. Gravitas. The Lord of hosts hath purposed it to stain the pride of all glory and to bring into contempt all the honorable of the earth. All the men of gravitas are going to have gravitas. Are going to be calling for the mountains to fall upon them and the gravitas of the mountain to hide them from the face of him that sits on the throne, the Lord of hosts. The Lord of hosts. What does that mean? I don't know if I've ever mentioned that because I just, again, sometimes I don't know what isn't known and I forget. People don't know. Hosts. What are hosts? You know, Twinkies, hostess Twinkies, or is it host a party? Well, it means an army. The Lord of hosts, the Lord of armies. For certainly he has his armies. Verse 10, pass through thy land as a river, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more strength. Look, pass through your land, flow, look through it, and then go cross your land, crisscross like a river. There's no more. He stretched out his hand over the sea. He shook the kingdoms. The Lord hath given a commandment against the merchant city to destroy the strongholds thereof. He said, thou shalt no more rejoice, O thou oppressed virgin, daughter of Zidon. Arise, pass over to Kittim, there also shalt thou have no rest. The idea is like flee off, you know, to Kittim, to Cyprus, or to the other islands of the sea. Where a lot of people didn't actually get out to the Mediterranean Sea, but they may know of Kittim or of other places out there, and it kind of all became known as the same thing. Unspecified locations in the Mediterranean, at least to the minds of most people in Isaiah's time. And for our purposes, it doesn't really matter. It's, you know, I guess the way I think of these things is like I'm thinking of what God does and how he moves things and how he prepares things and how prophetically, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, like what happens and then what happens after that and then what happens after that. And then I see parallels in the book of Revelation. They fall. Now, what about after the fall of Babylon? What then? How will people react? You know, we always talk about how there's a lot of mystery in what's going to happen in the millennium. A lot of the passages at the end of these burdens where God speaks of the restoration of these different people who are being punished give us a window of insight into perhaps what it's going to be like when the Lord returns, when Messiah appears and restores peace to the world and throws down the ultimate king of Babylon, the ultimate Antichrist, the ultimate Satan, when he defeats him and casts him into the pit for the 1,000 years, well, what's going to happen then? Well, again, like I said, I think we're going to get a little insight into that. And that's what I'm saying is because these events are similar, you know, the judgment, what happens after the judgment? You know, and that's how I look at it. That's how I look to these things to understand. Like, understand what people always mistakenly do is they try to look at the geographical locations and they say, okay, there's going to be war with this people against that people, and there's going to be these troops move there, they're going to attack them. And I think that trying to predict what the armies of so-and-so are going to do and all that based on past history and looking at the Old Testament prophecies, I just think that's just... how many times have they been wrong? Is anyone even keeping track? Because I think quite a bit. I just remember books coming out in the 80s and 90s about the Middle East and Bible prophecy. And there isn't enough Bible prophecy to cover all the stuff that's been going on in the Middle East. You know? But everything is just a further confirmation that these prophets are correct. All right, whatever. But always trying to predict what the bad guys are going to do. I can't predict what the bad guys are going to do, except what God says they're going to do. And what I see here is, remember, the king of Babylon is the bad guy, but he is God's instrument of punishment against the people of Tyre, who are people. He sends his servant, who's a bad guy, against them to punish them and to lay their cities waste, but later gives restoration. Well, I see that in the book of Revelation too. He sends the Antichrist, the beast, the false prophet. All those things come and they lead the world in a certain direction, away from God. And then he's bad. He's a bad actor. And so are the people who he overthrows. And those who are left over who benefit from the restoration, well, those are the people we often read about in these prophecies. I'm getting ahead of myself, but that's all right. I guess because that's the feeling I get as I go through all this. Thou shalt no more rejoice, thou oppressed virgin, in verse 12. Daughter of Zidon. That means that Zidon was the first city and Tyre was the daughter city. And when it says oppressed, it means humbled. And I believe in that sense, it means when someone humbles a virgin, it means she's had her virginity taken. Now, you know, the word virgin doesn't always mean a technical virgin. It may mean just a young girl. A lot of people make a big deal about a virgin shall conceive, how the word in the Old Testament Hebrew didn't specify a girl whose hymen was intact. It just specified a young girl. But the funny thing is the young girls whom that word specifies are to be reasonably expected to be virgins. Like if I said a 12-year-old, you would expect that, right? So when I'm talking about, you know, if I say, thou oppressed adolescent girl, do I have to say that, you know, you technical virgin, you? You know what I'm saying? So it is really a distinction without a difference. It's just a different word. So it's not, just because it's not specifying, the idea of a humbled, that is a euphemism. It speaks of like when someone has humbled a virgin that he must marry her in the law. And that reference is just slipping my mind at the moment where it is exactly, but he hath humbled her. You could search along those lines and you'll come up with it. Deuteronomy 21 verse 14, Deuteronomy 22 verse 24, Deuteronomy 22 verse 29. Flee to Kittim, there also you shall have no rest. You've been humbled. You know, the city, I suppose, to that point had not been conquered. It had always sort of avoided conflict. It's a merchant city. It's a different kind of an empire. They make money by trading over the sea, and all their merchandise coming and going is important. I mean, some people might want to take control of Tyre, right? They may want to control it, but they don't want to destroy it. No one wants to destroy the goose that lays the golden eggs. But if the goose doesn't want to lay for you, and they, for some reason, because, you know, here's the thing I know about God, is that when men don't want to do God's will, he puts hooks in their jaws and makes them do his will. So let's say, you know, for their best interest, and this is something you find in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul talks about it when it says, you know, if the princes of this world had the wisdom we have from God, they would not have crucified the Lord. And the same thing with this. If the king of Tyre had the wisdom of God, he would know not to resist the king of Babylon when he was in his ascendancy and not try to stay loyal to whatever other king they were loyal to, whether it was the Pharaoh or the king of Israel, whoever it was that they were resisting the king of Babylon on behalf of, it was a mistake. You know what I'm saying? So if they had their own best interests at heart, they would have known once again to change allegiances to the most powerful player. You know, when someone really powerful comes on the scene and you're a merchant like that, you just change allegiances to the one who is the biggest threat. And you pay your tribute and you bring in the trade. And why would they want to destroy you? You send out the ships, you give them their part. They're happy. They don't just, you know, a lot of these empires didn't destroy wantonly. They didn't just go, they weren't like the Vandals of the who invaded Rome and just destroyed all the works of art and stuff. We're talking about, you know, basically empires that met resistance. They didn't want to be reigned over by them. They didn't want to give over their control of their society to them and become part of this other empire. So they fought against them. Well, this time, she chose wrong, Tyre, daughter of Zidon, and she was humbled. And passing over to Kittim, to Cyprus, there would be no rest. To the Isles, you know why? Because I don't know exactly, it could be perhaps, I don't think, certainly not the Babylonians, they didn't become a Mediterranean sea power. The Persians certainly tried, but it may be that just the loss of their capital, the main city of their mercantile empire, Tyre, was such a blow that it would be difficult to recover from that. Plus, you know, people who are passing back into the Isles of the Sea away from Tyre have lost everything. They've lost their families, they've lost their homes, and so they are suffering. Verse 13. This is a verse that always confused me. And I had to look up what it means in another translation. But let's just read the King James and we'll talk about it. Behold the land of the Chaldeans. This people was not till the Assyrian founded it for them that dwell in the wilderness. They set up the towers thereof. They raised up the palaces thereof. And he brought it to ruin. Well, In some translations, they translate it more along the lines of this. And, you know, the King James only people would probably just disagree strongly and say, the King James is right. But it just seems kind of confusing. Because, behold, the land of the Chaldeans. This people was not till the Assyrian founded it for them that dwell in the wilderness. Now, that always sounded to me like the Assyrians founded some place in the wilderness for people to live. You know, like there was a wilderness and they set up a city for them, right? And then he brought it to ruin. Who, he? God? The Assyrian? You know, it's a little confusing. What does it mean? I guess a lot of modern translators put it more like this. The land of the Chaldeans, this people are no longer a people, basically. Like, this people is not was not. The Assyrian not founded it. What it is they left it or destroyed it and left it for the creatures who live in the wilderness. Them that dwell in the wilderness would, in their mind, means the wild beasts. You know what I'm saying? In the modern translation, they'll say, like, they left it for the wild beasts of the desert. They set up the towers of, they're raised up. Now, the word raised up, in my notes, when I looked at it, I got the word demolished there. Which sort of makes sense, because they set up the they raised towers against it. They decimated the palaces. He brought it to ruin. And I guess the idea was that the Assyrians conquered the Chaldeans. Now, the notes in my Bible, which are not my notes, basically look at this verse like, the people were not a people, referring to the Assyrians. But it does refer to the Chaldeans, which are the people from whom the Babylonian city sprang. Though Assyria is right there. I mean, is there really any difference from them? It's just a rival city from basically the same people. So I'm not sure if it refers to the Assyrians destroying old Babylon when they set up their empire, or the Assyrians founding the land of the Chaldeans. It doesn't really say what city this people was not. They laid the land of the Chaldeans waste. They raised up the towers against it. Well, I think what he's saying is, either way, this is he's saying to Tyre, look at this situation. And either way you want to look at it, it's meant to be given as a lesson to them. Tyre, you know, they were the ancient city, the crowning city. Their merchants were princes. Their traffickers were honorable. They were all filled with pride. They were a glorious merchant city. And he's saying, here, look at these nobodies in the wilderness. They've been brought to ruin. Or this people that were an important city, the Chaldeans, or whatever, that these Chaldeans were not, they were not until the Assyrian came along, but rather they became not after the Assyrian came and decimated them and raised the towers against them and were brought to ruin. Because remember, in ancient times, the Babylonians go way back. They've had their ups and downs. And it doesn't even mention Babylonia. I'm just saying that, but it's the Chaldeans. I'm not sure exactly the distinction on that. But the idea is basically, and I'm just trying to understand what Isaiah means here. And I think what it's saying is they were an ancient people. They were an important people. They got destroyed. They were brought to ruin. What, you think you're better? Yeah, they were great and honorable and princes until the Assyrian came along and turned their cities into wilderness and broke down their palaces. I think that's what he's saying. Verse 14. How, you ships of Tarshish, for your strength is laid waste. And it shall come to pass in that day that Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years, according to the days of one king. After the end of 70 years shall Tyre sing as an harlot. Ah. Sing as an harlot. See, we have merchants associating with a whore. There's a strong correlation between mercantilism, the activity of the merchants, the commerce, the trading of goods, the wealth, the decadence, and harlotry. And you see that in the book of Revelation, chapter 17 and 18. It's also present in chapter 28 when it talks about the prince of Tyre. Ezekiel 28. Did I say that? Or is it just chapter 28? Ezekiel 28. The prince of Tyre. You know, he by the multitude of thy merchandise, they have filled the midst of thee with evil. That, you know, wealth and goods, it creates greed. And it creates discontent, jealousy, violence, wickedness. These were the sins of Sodom. Pride, fullness of bread, the abundance of idleness. Those are the sins of America. For every abomination is also in her. If I was going to draw a comparison to America, it would not be the ships of Kittim or whatever reference to Kittim you like. We are the merchant city. We are the whore whose greed for goods is enriching the entire world. And we have so much money, we spend it on all these goods and products from all over the world. It's why people in China have jobs, you know, to make all the knickknacks for the Americans. And some people may be like, yeah, it's terrible. Well, if we didn't buy their knickknacks, what would they be doing instead? You know, scratching out more rice in the rice paddy or what? You know, there's always a lot of pain in that growth, and I'm not going to judge it here. It's neither here nor there. Prosperity in and of itself isn't a bad thing. It's often used as a sign of God's blessing, like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were very blessed, very wealthy men. But it is also the source of temptation. Just like David, being king was a blessing, right? But it became a temptation to him because he had all this power. And he had so much power that he could actually send the husband of the woman he was lusting after into battle so that he would be killed. You know, see to it, Uriah is at the front of the battle and that he dies. But being king was a blessing of God. So also wealth and prosperity can destroy us. It is enjoyable and comforting, and it is good in this world to have enough to eat, to have sufficient money for clothing and to raise your family and whatever else you need. But too much of it makes you idle, makes you fat. Wow. Bald eagles are hunting out there right now. I'm looking out the window of my barn. It makes you fat, idle, and sinful. Too much. It can. It takes an awfully godly man to be able to to receive all that earthly good. That's why in the Gospels, you know, Jesus, when he's running into these rich young guys or other rich people, a lot of times he's like, it's so hard for the rich to enter into the kingdom of heaven. You know, it's so hard for them because they have to divest themselves of good things, of things that make you feel good in this life. You know, it's good to have that power that money gives you. You see something, you want it, it's yours. Just take it. I mean, you're changing your money for it, but you've got the power to obtain whatever. Money is power. It is the power to just, you know, I can just hand this thing, money, to people, and they will give me the things I want. And too much of that can really mess with your mind. Let's get back to Tyre in verse 15. And that she's going to be forgotten 70 years. To me, that means the city is going to be laid waste for 70 years. according to the days of one king. And I'm not sure what it means by that phrase. Whether it means, okay, E.W. Bullinger to the rescue. His note says, one king means ikad, a compound unity, hence one of a dynasty. Here, the Babylonian dynasty, not Yahid, a single one. Like one king. So it's according to the days of a dynasty. And this would be the city of Tyre was laid waste from the first year of Nebuchadnezzar to the conquest of Babylon by Cyrus. And the precise years on that, I have some figures here. I don't know how reliable, but it's from about 500 BC to about 430. And that's just rough. It gives a much more specific date, but I always question these dates in my Bible because I know that there's been more recent archaeology and stuff. So, but I don't know, and that's not so important. But anyway, Bishiat 70 years according to the days of one king. After that, at the end of 70 years, Tyre shall sing as a harlot. Sorry, take an harp, go about the city. The harlot that has been forgotten. I mean, the singing of the whores in the streets. Who can forget? Obviously, this isn't something we have, but in the old times, I suppose that's what they did. How do they get attention? I mean, there you could, you know, they in the movies, there was these very crass images of prostitutes plying their wares. But maybe in the ancient times, it was common for them to go forth and sing. Woman available! You know, 40 shekels of silver for a night, or whatever. I mean, you know, they would go about the streets singing to tempt men. Make sweet melody. Sing many songs that thou mayest be remembered. But again, this is Tyre trying to be remembered. 70 years is an interesting time period. You know, there's 70 years after her judgment. Don't you see the parallel here? I see a parallel. After the judgment comes, the king of Babylon, and he's overthrown, you know, there is no whore anymore. The great whore is burned with fire, you know. But at the end of 1,000 years in Revelation, the dragon is released out of the pit to go forth and deceive the nations. And he does deceive them. And they go up upon the face of the earth, encompass the camp of the saints about. And the dragon once again entices men to go to war against God. And I think there's reasons why they'd be willing to do that. Primarily because I think for the most part in the millennium, people are not going to, Jesus will be here, but he's not going to let everybody see him anymore. After the first day, he's going to kind of keep shut up, I think, for the most part. Not everyone's going to get to see him all the time. He's not going to be sitting around on TV. He's going to use his saints. And after 1,000 years of that, people are going to grumble. They're not going to like it. They're going to want things to be the way they were. Then the Antichrist is going to pull up. He's going to tell them all kinds of lies about whatever and how he can save the day. You know, the generation that saw Jesus return is going to die off, I believe. I have a tape on the millennium, and this scripture doesn't come into it, but it certainly would if I had thought about it, because there's something parallel, although it's not very specific. I'm just saying in a general typological sense that there's something here. She's forgotten, this whore is forgotten for 70 years. Then she comes back and starts singing her songs again. Come with me. Because remember, the whore is not anybody. It's just a category people fall into. And they start gathering more people together to commit fornication. Which is, in that term it is meant spiritually. To commit fornication with the whore is to sort of join her in her worship of the dragon. Because she is the great fornicator. She is laying with the dragon when she was espoused to one husband, even Christ. But instead, she goes off and plays the harlot with the Antichrist. And once again, she's singing her songs. But what did it mean in his days? You know, maybe I'm wrong about that. That's just speculation. I think in a sense, after 70 years, they're going to start singing, "Hey, how about Tyre? How about Tyre? Remember the merchant city? Remember all the wealth we used to bring in?" You know, she's singing her song of like, how great it would be to rebuild Tyre, huh? We could bring in all that silver and gold again and all the grain and the trade. We could restore everything. How about rebuilding Tyre? Remember Tyre. Take an harp, go about the city. All right, we said that. Verse 17, and it shall come to pass after the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre. And she shall turn to her hire and shall commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth. How about that? She's going to commit fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. The merchants of the earth have waxed rich. Revelation 18. All the kings of the earth are going to commit fornication with Mystery Babylon. There are many types which, you know, have different roles in the Old Testament. But the New Testament, you know, you got to look at the book of Revelation as sort of pulling everything together. And what you can do is you can look back at the old prophecies and see details that may refer to how things are going to play out in the end and find some detail that is not actually given in Revelation because they're typological. You can recognize the type because the references are made in the New Testament. And then you can use the Old Testament thing to speculate a little bit. You know, don't do too much speculation. I don't like it. Because it is speculation. We don't know. The thing is, when it fits in with what's already there, you want to be careful you don't just sort of create for yourself this sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, but where you're basically, you know, building on your own evidence. You're sort of like, you're making a selective use of evidence to make a point. You've already got the conclusion. And I can say honestly, I never really had an idea of my current views on the millennium are not something I started out trying to make fit. My original teacher taught me the millennium would be this great time of teaching, and everyone who never had heard of Jesus was going to get a chance to hear about him, and there'd be these classrooms, and we'd all be teachers, kind of like Arnold Murray, and I mean, he doesn't really say classroom, but we'd all be sitting there with our rods of iron and wrap the knuckles of them and get them to whatever. We would get them in line, you know, but in line always meant something like, don't worship the devil, and here's what the Bible really teaches. It's funny because that's all Arnold Murray seemed to, the only sin he seemed really worried about was, I mean, he didn't like drug use. I know that. There were a lot of things he didn't like, but it was very much like, hey, you know, don't worship the devil. That's the main message. But there's so much more to it than that. No one just says like, well, I'll just choose to worship the devil and I'll perish in the lake of fire. Doesn't that sound like a plan? Nobody says that. What it is they say, like, I can't live without this sinful thing I desire. So I have to worship the devil because he's the one who gives these things to me. Or without him, I can't have these things, or whatever. And not that it's rationalized in that level, but what leads people to Satan is not just a bald choice between God. Is it God or Satan? Choose. You know, like, you know, some people for being stinkers will say, well, I choose the devil. But that's just, they're just being provocative needlessly. I'm just saying, you know, if you're choosing between life and death, and you're not mentally ill or disturbed in some way by events in your life, a healthy, sound person is going to choose life. Life is good. And a healthy, sound person is going to choose God. I'll take God. He's the one giving out life, right? No one's just going to choose the devil. And they wouldn't choose the serpent, except the serpent was offering things. If you eat of this tree, you'll be like God. So he had something to offer. He wasn't just there saying like, hey, worship me. He tried that with Jesus, but he didn't just say, hey, worship me. He said, hey, look at all these kingdoms. I bet you'd like to be king over all of them. You are the king, aren't you? King of kings. I can give them to you right now. No need to die and all that stuff. I'll give them to you today. I've been given this power. I can give it to whoever I will. And I'll give it to you today. Today I offer to you, Jesus. All you got to do is bow down and worship me. He never says, well, what'd you rather do? Worship me or God? That doesn't work like that. And the same thing, there's no amount of teaching in the millennium. What are you going to do? Just keep cracking them on the knuckles? Well, I'm getting off on a tangent. But the point is, I always believed from his teaching, from the time I was 19, that the millennium was going to be this time of teaching. And I do believe there is an element of that. There's a second resurrection at the end of the 1,000 years. The rest of the dead live not again till the 1,000 years are finished. Not just spiritually, just in any sense. They did not live. They were not walking around. They were not walking and talking and learning. They weren't doing anything. They were being dead. That is not a position I came to willingly, but I was compelled along by the scriptures. So all the things I have to say about the millennium are things I have genuinely come to believe from studying the scripture. That doesn't mean they're right. It just means I have sincerely obtained these things and have tried to be as even-handed as possible in trying to flesh out a consistent view of what it's all supposed to be. You know, what is the millennium supposed to be like? Some people say, well, you favor the premillennial. I'm like, yeah, I do, because I think that's the best case. I've looked at the case for the amillennial view, and I just don't think it's very compelling. It's true, I didn't start off with that view, but that doesn't mean that if I found that to be the most compelling case scripturally, that I wouldn't have followed that. I looked at that evidence. And I looked at the passages like in Matthew, you know, where it seems like the judgment is immediate, where it seems like you think like, well, you know, the lake of fire happens right after Jesus returns. I mean, I get it. But I have, but there are other scriptures that I did not hear explained sufficiently so that I could fit them into an amillennial view. And look at, my teaching on the millennium is where we ought to go with that, because I am not prepared for a millennial talk, and I'm just being kind of drawn into that because I want to assert parallels with the millennium right here in Isaiah. There is a little bit of that. All I'm saying is we may have a little insight there, okay? She shall turn to her hire, shall commit fornication while the kings of the earth, of the world upon the face of the earth. That sounds pretty universal. And her merchandise and her hire shall, but it could also be a bit of a hyperbole, meaning just all the nations for the most part. Verse 18, and her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness to the Lord. It shall not be treasured nor laid up, for her merchandise shall be for them that dwell before the Lord, to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing. Now that may sound kind of weird. I mean, it does, right? Basically saying, comparing Tyre to a whore, and then saying the whore's hire is going to be holiness to the Lord. How can that be? Well, because it is what is real. She's not really a literal prostitute. Her hire is her merchandise. See, here's the thing. The same money that I use to maintain my life, to do Bible studies, to write music, and to have time for all that, to raise my family in a godly and peaceable fashion, the same money I need and use for that is the same money that other people use to give themselves over to consumerism and to pleasuring themselves in ungodly ways, etc., etc., etc. Meaning the money itself, you know, I think that in the Old Covenant, though, you know, certain things that, like, the price of a whore was not, like, the thing, that money was not acceptable. Deuteronomy 23:18, thou shalt not bring the hire of a whore or the price of a dog into the house of the Lord thy God for any vow. For even both these are abomination unto the Lord thy God. That's why this looks to the New Testament, because the New Testament is not about the letter. The New Covenant under Messiah is not about the letter of law, but about the Spirit. Ultimately, the same food that feeds a fat man and whatever is the same food that feeds the hungry. The same gold that adorns the excessive person who gives over to excess and to, you know, the birds are flying in, and gives themselves over to the excesses of this world, that same gold could be sold and give the money given to buy food for the poor or whatever. The point is, the rebuilding of this whore, the merchandise is not going to just go to waste. Her hire will be for God's people, for them that dwell before the Lord, to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing. Now, if this is, again, I don't know if the 7 years represents the millennial intervention or whatever. Maybe that's just, I'm off my rocker with that. Because then if I consider this, at the end of 70 years, when the Lord visits Tyre, she shall, now that means for restoring in a good sense, to rebuild the city. All right. And so I'm going to take that in the sense of, like, God is going to destroy the world, so to speak, when Jesus comes. He's going to overthrow the world order. The cities and the nations are going to be broken down. The world's going to be shaken with massive earthquakes and geological events and events from the, you know, cosmic events. We're talking about meteors and stuff like that. The sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, and those things will come on the earth. All right, that's all coming. That's going to happen. But then afterwards, there's going to be a restoration after he punishes everything. And what is left of the harlots' merchandise and all that, he's going to let me put it this way. The whole world is going to need to be fed. The whole world is going to need clothing. The whole world, the people, God isn't going to kill everybody. There's going to be people left over. People who do not participate in the first resurrection, yet are not worthy of instantaneous punishment. Those are the people who will inhabit the millennium and who will be the subjects of God's kingdom. They are the ones who will be giving birth to new generations. They will repopulate the earth. I believe this. And so what it's saying is that it also reminds me of the 70 weeks of Daniel, which we're going to do a little side study on that. I don't know how soon, but it eventually will be done. So I got other things on my mind right now. But her merchandise, her hire shall be holiness to the Lord. They're going to have to rebuild the commerce of the world. There's going to have to be food production. There's going to have to be clothing produced. There's going to have to be some sort of resurrection of this mercantile system. There's going to have to be, because the kingdom that God is bringing on earth is an idealized earthly world. Yeah, I mean, it is his kingdom on this world with people in it. It's not the eternal heavenly, new heavens and new earth that are promised. It's still this world, but changed. It'll be a new age, a new kind of world that we entirely don't know what it's going to be like. But this implies that perhaps the old system, what is left of it, will be rebuilt, meaning the world that we know now will be rebuilt in some fashion, at least to the degree that there will be for them that dwell before the Lord to eat sufficiently and have durable clothing. Having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. So, That's what I get out of this, is I see some definite parallels to Revelation, some perhaps insights to the millennium. And that's what makes this a very interesting chapter. And I also have a song for The Burden of Tyre, which you can download from oraclesofgod.org, along with all the other studies in the Isaiah series and all my other line-by-line studies and specials, just by following the links around the page there. Thanks for listening, and hope to be with you again soon.